Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is a woman who's been in the forefront of online promotion and social media for a long time, Ariel Hyatt. But first, let's talk about something that actually might be really good for the business if the trend continues, and that's the fact that the album is making a comeback. If you've looked at the figures over the last 5, 6, 7 years, you've seen that the album total sales have taken a beating. And when I say total sales, what I mean is the sales of CDs, downloads, digital albums, and vinyl. If you add all those together, the sales have been decreasing down and down and down every year. Last year, as a matter of fact, the total sales were down 11.2%, and even digital sales, digital albums, were down 9%. So why? Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, the rise of streaming. Streaming is all about the single. Let's face it, we just want to hear the single. We really don't buy albums when it comes to streaming, even though we can, but we usually just buy the songs that we really like. The other reason is the fact that consumers, music consumers, have felt really burned for a long time by the album. And this is mostly when the CD came around from that point. The reason why was prior to that, you could have about 40 minutes, 45 minutes at the most on an album, on a vinyl album, which meant that you had 7 or 8 songs. It felt like, even if there's only 1 or 2 good ones, it still felt like good value for the money that you were paying. And most of the time, you weren't paying all that much. You're paying $5.99, $6.99, $7.99, $8.99 at the most. You really weren't paying a lot for a vinyl album at the time. When the CDs came out, though, that's when everything changed, because the price has just about doubled because of the technology factor, or so the record labels called it. Then you also had the ability to have 76 minutes, 76 plus, on a CD. And the temptation was to try to fill up as much of that time as possible. So suddenly, instead of the 7 or 8 songs that you got on a vinyl album, now you were getting 10 or 12. And the problem was that out of those 10 or 12, there's only 1 or 2 good ones. So now people are paying twice as much money. And even though they're getting more music, if you don't like the music, if you don't want that music, it's not a good buy. So everybody felt that they're paying a lot of extra money for filler that they didn't want. And that was one of the reasons why when the MP3 came along, suddenly consumers felt liberated because they could just buy the songs that they wanted. They can cherry pick everything. And of course, in the streaming world, that's exactly what happens. So the album has lost a lot of importance up until this last quarter. All of a sudden, we had a big bump in album sales. Really, what that amounts to is digital albums are up 2.2%. And even total album sales were only down 1.9%, 1.8%, something like that. That feels like a victory when all of a sudden you're decreasing less than you were. Now, why? Well, one of the reasons that people look at is the fact that Drake has a big album that just came out, a big digital album. It's called If You're Reading This, It's Too Late. Many in the business attribute that to the uptick in sales. Some also say it's the fact that vinyl is up yet another 52% over last year, and it was up 52% last year as well. So suddenly, vinyl sales are becoming pretty significant, except for the fact that that only amounts to about 2.7 million. And really, when you look at this in the grand scheme of things, it's less than 5% of the total business, the total album sales. So we're still looking at digital albums. We're still looking at CD sales, and CDs aren't coming back. But as I told you in another podcast, I think 2 or 3 ago, CDs aren't going away either, at least not as fast as everybody thinks. Now, they're going to be obsolete sooner or later, and you won't see them as much, but they're going to be around for a little while. Again, the good news is the album sales are up, and the album, as a concept, isn't going away just yet. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's called 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio, and you can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn a lot more. Let's move over to music production now. I wrote something in the Mixing Engineer's Handbook that's kind of interesting. I just read it the other day, and I thought, wow, this is a good excerpt to really pull out of the bag, so to speak. And it's five simple EQ tips that you can use in just about any situation. They're really simple tips, but if you keep them in the back of your mind, you'll find that you'll be referring to them more and more. The first one is, if the sound is muddy, just cut a little bit at 250 hertz. 250 hertz is kind of a magic number there. And all the numbers I'm going to give you are kind of magic in the sense that if you cut a little bit in this particular area or you cut or boost in the particular areas I tell you, you're going to find that's going to make a difference. Now, it might not be exactly 250. It might be 220. It might be 280. It might be 200. But in that general area, you'll find if you cut a little bit, all of a sudden, your muddiness is going to go away. The second tip, if the sound is honky or it sounds veiled, cut a little bit at 500 hertz. Now, the reason why 500 hertz is significant is the fact that when you have a directional mic and you put it up against a guitar, for instance, or a vocalist is singing in close to it, you're going to get proximity effect. And proximity effect tends to build up around the 500 cycles area. And what that means is if you use that same mic on a number of different instruments, a number of different elements, all of a sudden you have this big buildup in the 500 hertz area. And again, it could be 450, it could be 550, or it could be 400. It's in that general mid-range area. But you'll find if you just cut a little bit there, suddenly everything is a little bit more detailed. And you don't have to cut much. Sometimes just a couple dB is all you need. But all of a sudden you'll find that things aren't quite as honky or as veiled as they were before. Number three is really easy. If you want things to sound clearer, instead of boosting your EQ, use the cut instead. And you'll find that things will suddenly clean up a little bit. They'll get clearer. Many times we all do this. We all grab the EQ and the first thing we'll do is we'll boost. We'll add a little bit. Well, let's just add a dB or two here and there. And what you find is sometimes you should just go the opposite way. You should decrease a little bit. You should cut. Because you'll find things will get clearer. It'll sound a lot better. The opposite of that is number four, which is if you want things to sound different, that's the time to boost. You can make the sound much more different by boosting. Cutting cleans things up. It makes it clearer. Boosting makes it sound different. Number five is a big one. It takes a long time to learn sometimes, and took me a long time. And that's you can't boost something if it's not there. And a lot of times you'll find engineers try to do this on the high end, for instance. And I used to get tapes in, for instance, that had no high end whatsoever, where it was just all rolled off, mostly because it was an old tape and all the oxide was gone. And no matter what you did, you couldn't put that 10K back in. It just wasn't there. Instead, what you get is a lot of noise. And that's just about true for any frequency. If it's not there to begin with, it doesn't matter how much you try to boost that frequency, you're not going to get it back. It doesn't matter if it's a nice, clean digital equalizer. All you're going to boost is the noise. So those are the five really simple EQ tips. If it's muddy, cut it around 250 hertz. If it sounds honky or veiled, cut it 500 hertz. Cut to make things sound clearer, boost to make things sound different, and you can't boost something if it's not there to begin with. My guest today is Ariel Hyatt, who has worked as a traditional publicist, but she actually saw the digital writing on the wall a long time before most other people did, especially most other publicists. So she went on to create Cyber PR, and they specialize specifically in online PR. She's really been on the cutting edge of just about everything that has to do with social media. And because of that, she's really helped mold her clients' online strategy, not just in social media, but on everything. For a long time, Ariel concentrated just on music clients, but recently she's expanded to tech and entrepreneurs as well. I spoke with Ariel from her office via Skype. Ariel, thank you so much for being with me. I always enjoy speaking with you, and this is always a treat.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You're more plugged in than anybody I know into social media, and obviously that's your gig. That's what you do. What is the latest that you see in social media? What's the latest trends?
It's an interesting time in social right now. Well, thank you first for saying I'm the most plugged in, because just coming back from South by Southwest and seeing all my interactive cronies, I feel like I'm the least plugged in, but that's good. So there was an interesting article that got written about sort of all of the noise that got made on all social media platforms. That fascinated me. And they focused on music, which is good because that's what you focus on. And what it said was 53% of all social media activity that got posted around South by Music 2015 happened on Instagram.
Oh.
The second, it's somewhere in the 33% was Facebook. Twitter was in 14-15%, so a distant third. And then there were other types of platforms kind of nudging their way into the atmosphere. Obviously, we saw Meerkat had their huge kind of coming out party at South By, and then it had its wings very dramatically clipped by Twitter. And now we're seeing Periscope as kind of the new solution. I think they're interesting platforms to look at from a live streaming standpoint. I think it's very exciting that you can now bring all of your Twitter followers into a live stream. So for those of you who like to stay on the edge of social media, I think you would be foolish to overlook, keep your eye on Meerkat, but definitely look at Periscope and read some articles about, you know, what you're seeing. What you're seeing there, I think, is going to be good.
How do you see Facebook integrating with everything? Has that peaked? Has it peaked in your business? Is there? I know we talked about this at least a year ago, maybe more, and you were kind of negative on it only because of. The reach is so limited anymore unless you pay for it.
Yeah. It's funny. I've been negative around Facebook for even before it was trendy to be. I can't say I was having some sort of crystal ball moment, but Facebook, the reality is there's still 1.3 billion people on it. They are not going away anytime soon. Although when I talk to my friends who have young teenage children, they think Facebook is like for old people. So it's yet to be seen about what the next generation is going to do with Facebook, but you can't deny its hold on us. The statistics are still shocking. How many people log in every day? How many people log in from mobile? We're still seeing increased numbers in engagement on Facebook. And yes, it is now a pay-to-play platform. Although I've been testing advertising, and I'm sure you have, and I'd love to hear some of your feedback. This week, I started testing advertising again, and I'm finding that the results are getting better. I'm finding that spending your money is looking a little bit more promising. Now, I don't know. I still always struggle with how artists and musicians should spend their money on Facebook to get a result. So it doesn't become an exercise in narcissism, but it actually becomes something that has a payoff that comes to fruition. So that being said, Facebook is still where you will find the vast majority of your friends, probably still. And of course, your family, and it's easier to see those in your community. And I think everyone should still have a Facebook strategy. I'm not saying desert it anytime soon, but understanding how the advertising platform works and how and what to boost, I think, is key information that you need to take forward for the next few months, or at least.
I've been advertising on Facebook for well over a year with great results, actually. And this is mostly for my coaching programs, but it's worked great. A byproduct was I got a lot of likes, not actually trying to get them, but just in terms of lead generation, Facebook has been terrific. And one of the reasons why I kind of went to Facebook was because I went to Google jail. Are you familiar with what happens there?
No, but I'd love to hear about it.
Well, essentially what happened was Google frowns upon doing the types of things that seem to be very common online, which is trading something for an email address. Unfortunately, that's against Google AdWords terms of use. and they shut you down for it. And they're very nice about it. You can speak with them on the phone. You can actually get someone on the phone, and they'll help you as much as they can, except like with a lot of big corporations, they give you differing information on what's going to work. You talk to one person and they say, do this. And then you talk to another person. They said, no, you shouldn't have done that. Do this instead. But the whole thing was they basically say you cannot trade an ebook or whatever for an email address.
And that using the Google ad platform.
Yes.
So you can't buy Google ads. Wow, I actually did not know that.
And what I said to him is, wait a second, there's a million plus other people that are doing that. And the reply I get was, yes, and we're going to get them all.
Oh, wow.
So since then, I've talked to a lot of people, and I have a marketing mentor, actually an online marketing mentor. And I went to that mentor and I said, have you ever heard anything like this? And he kind of sheepishly said to me, yes, we've had to pay lots of money to get out of Google jail. There are companies that specialize just in that, believe it or not.
Yeah, I do believe it. I did have a client that, unfortunately, she had a very emotional thing happen to her. Years ago, she had experienced some horrible stress in her life, and she shoplifted one day, and she was under great duress and basically having a nervous breakdown. And the shoplifting article is the only thing that you can find when you Google her. Mm. And it was years ago, and she was actually pardoned. She wasn't guilty of it. It was just a person having a really bad day. And she told me that she got out of Google jail by paying a strategist to help her make those articles not go away totally, but at least go down in the Google searches so that she could actually launch her business and career and not be seen in a bad light.
Well, as a result, I've taken my advertising to Facebook, and probably very fortuitously, because it's worked out very well, and it is working better than the results I was getting on Google. Now, that being said, I know a couple of managers, two of them, that will promote or do Facebook ads primarily to get likes for their clients.
Mm-hmm.
So in my case, I'm looking for lead generation, and what I want is everyone to port over to a website that I have, or a landing page. But in that case, all they want is people to like their client more. And they say that it works great, but, you know, it costs money.
Right.
So is this a strategy that you subscribe to?
Well, you know, when we all started working it with the Facebook back in the day, we didn't have to pay. So I think it's really hard when you get used to something being a certain way and then all of a sudden it gets taken away. You have to ask yourself, why do I want more likes on Facebook? Just to have more likes is only the beginning of a strategy. And so you have to ask yourself, why do I want more likes? You know, you just mentioned earlier in this conversation, the halo effect of looking for leads was that you got likes. I would encourage any artist or anyone who, if you're running a production house or a studio or you're looking for leads, I think getting likes is a fabulous halo effect of lead generation. But just to get likes because you want to have more likes, you have to ask yourself, what is the reason for that? Now, if a specific company says, like someone that you're looking to have sponsor you, or a record label or a booking agent says, I don't work with anyone who has fewer than X amount of likes, okay, that would be a reason. But, you know, I think we live in a day and age where people begin to not respect huge numbers unless there's something to back those numbers up. So, I mean, you've seen it, I've seen it, we've all seen it. Artists will call me and tell me about how popular they are, and I'll look at their Facebook and they've got 20,000, 30,000, 50,000, 100,000 likes or more. And then it doesn't take much. You just click on the little insights button and anyone can see, do those likes speak English? Are those likes in the United States? If that artist is in the US and all of their fans are not, unless there's a real reason for them to be world famous in, I don't know, Pakistan, perhaps you should look and see that that is not a like base with any integrity. So I would much rather see, and I think most smart people would much rather see, a smaller number of likes with a higher amount of engagement and people responding and reacting. So I think the answer is anyone can pay a lot of money now to get likes, but what do they really do for you? And where is your strategy beyond just getting to the magical number that you think is the good number, whether it's 10,000 or a million?
You know, there was an article I recently read, and it was a journalist for, I don't want to say the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal, but it was a respectable blog or newspaper. And they did an experiment. What they did was they bought 10,000 likes to see what would happen.
Yes, I saw this video. It's incredible.
And they found that, in fact, likes begot likes, more likes. And again, it's one reason that you might want them. But again, just like you said, to what end? What good does that do you?
Right. And I mean, as someone who has, even before it was ever talked about, I was the girl talking about engagement, two-way engagement, authentic engagement. You got to get people talking to you. You have to talk back to them. Obviously, those basic tenets of social media use. If you are just getting likes and you don't see any lift whatsoever in any of the two-way conversation happening, you know you've got a big Facebook problem.
Well, speaking of which, has Twitter peaked? And I'm just talking about engagement here because, you know, that's supposedly the king of engagement, but has it peaked?
Maybe, maybe not. I think Twitter has always been the most interesting social site because it's the one that you can show the most with. It maybe has peaked in that they can't seem to get their user base to really swell. I think it's still 500 million people are signed up and about 200 million actually use it.
It's pretty flat. It's not growing.
Yeah, it's not growing, but you know, I think that the people that use it, current company included, I really still see major, major benefits to using it and to using it well. And I could say that truly about any social site. If you use even just one, don't worry about all of them. Using one really, really well, creating relationships, creating connections, creating interactions on one is a far better strategy than being everywhere and doing all of them not well.
Well, that being said, though, is that part of the strategy that you suggest to a client? You have a new client and they're not, even if they're in already versed in social media, obviously you're going to guide them in a way where they're going to maximize where they're at. Has your strategy changed or has your approach changed to online strategy?
Oh, it has to. I mean, we wouldn't be able to call ourselves an online strategy company unless we were consistently adjusting. Because things ebb and flow here so quickly. So yes, I mean, what I recommended even a year or two ago, even 8 months ago, might not be as modern and as relevant today. And I was with a dear friend who runs a marketing company similar to mine. And she was in a meeting with a manager who started talking about a somewhat antiquated way of online marketing. And everybody in the meeting was like, anyway, you know, so it's not that that was that manager was wrong or bad. It's just, you know, he knew what he knew because it's not his job to do that. And something maybe worked a year or two ago for one of his clients. And he still thought, yes, that's the way it works. So you really do have to stay on top of the new things, the things where people are going, and stay on top of what is actually effective.
Now, you do much more than just musicians and artists. And I know you've expanded over the years. Would YouTube fit differently into different clients, into their strategy? For instance, that it's a big thing, obviously, for an artist to have a YouTube strategy. But is it as important for another type of client that you have?
Absolutely. The type of clients that we tend to work with are entrepreneurs, people with ideas, and a fabulous way to show off a concept, an idea, a philosophy is by making videos, either of you explaining your idea or your concept. It could be of you giving a talk. It could be an animated illustration of your concept or idea. People learn, as we know now, differently. Some people are audio learners. Some people are visual. Some people like to read things. Some people, you know, do better with an experience of looking and listening. And that's why different mediums exist for the internet, and why a podcasting campaign works really, really well, as could a video campaign. So I think a huge part of a great strategy is to have a video that shows who you are, shows your personality, shows what you stand for, and illustrates what it is you want to sell, whether you're a musician or an author or a lecturer, or you're writing a memoir and you want to illustrate a piece of it by reading it or doing a dramatic reenactment. Video is a fantastic way to get the message across. And you don't need to do a YouTube strategy where you're posting videos every week or every day, or, you know, getting to the millions of views. In the case of a lot of the clients we work with, they don't need a million views. They don't even need 10,000 views. They just need the right 100 views in order to have enough business or work for the next 5 years. So it really depends on what you are offering and who you're targeting. And that's the key.
Now, when you talk about views for videos, does that include Facebook now? Because Facebook is emphasizing or trying to emphasize the video part of things. So is that part of your strategy as well?
Absolutely. And we have seen that videos perform extremely well on Facebook.
I haven't done much of that yet. I know what's going on there. I'm familiar with their emphasis on it, but it's just not something that I've personally tried. I can see why it would work.
Yeah, I could too. And I think also, you know, I think about the old school iteration of videos where we used to, not we, but some marketers and people that were selling things, you know, you'd make a video and be like, hi, welcome to my website. Click here below to get something or see something. Or, you know, I mean, that's obviously antiquated and doesn't work anymore. So, you know, you have to get smarter with your video strategy and figure out like what and how is going to be effective for your users.
Let's talk about something that I think is primary to most musicians' strategy. Whether it's viable or not is another thing, but that's crowdfunding. It seems like most artists and musicians in general feel that they should be doing a crowdfunding thing, and sometimes for the right reasons, sometimes for the wrong reasons. And the reason why I say that is I have a friend that spent a bunch of money making an album. Then he came to me for some crowdfunding strategy. And he said, I said, why do you want to do this? And he said, well, I spent a lot of money. I want to get it back. I said, oh, wait a second. That's not a good reason. That's not going to work. So you spent a lot of time in crowdfunding, and you're writing a book, right, on it?
I am. I've been writing a book for quite some time. It's now getting embarrassing, but we're coming to the tail end, and it will come out soon. It's called CrowdStart. And it's interesting that you say that, because that artist that said that, I totally understand where that comes from, because with all the news that we're getting about streaming and Spotify and all these things that are paying artists less, if you do go out, and I'm always still, Bobby, shocked at how much money artists spend on their albums. I mean, I talk to artists, I don't often ask them how much they spend, because I feel like it's sort of like asking how much do you pay for rent in your house? Like, it's a bit rude, but you know, they volunteer these numbers that shock me. 10,000, 20,000. We just signed an artist from LA. He spent $60,000 making his album.
Oh.
And, you know, I'm not, it's shocking to me, because then, you know, we charge $5,000 to do a huge online promotion and they can barely scrape the money together. And I think, wow, your priority is a bit skewed here. But I could understand that need and that want to get that money back. That was investment you made. However, what I've seen with crowdfunding is there has to be a purpose. There has to be a journey that you're taking your crowd on with you. You cannot be motivated by, I want my money back, because that people will smell that so desperately. I mean, that's sort of like when you go out on the date with the person who's dying to get married, you're like, ew, something doesn't feel right here. Or they've got this agenda, you know, that has nothing to do with, are we enjoying this thing? So I think that really needs to be looked at with crowdfunding. And what also needs to be looked at is just the sad fact that, of course, there's fewer record deals, there's fewer book deals, there's fewer publishing deals. The deals that we see, I mean, some of my clients that used to be signed to major labels, I mean, they get these deal memos back and they're laughing. They're like, I don't even know what to do with this. This is so little money for the same fabulous intellectual property that they're still creating. All these years later, it's just, they're not getting paid as much. So where do we turn? We turn to crowdfunding, because this is actually a proven way to get some money in your pocket, in the bank, in the kitty, to fund your dream, whatever that is. So I do see a lot of artists feel like they need to, but I think they feel they need to because they don't feel much of a alternative.
You know, it's funny though, because everybody feels that they could do this crowdfunding, but the fact of the matter is, for an artist, for a band, unless you already have a following, it's all for naught, because you can't raise money if you don't have a following. You don't have people that are already interested in you. And even if you do, it's still tough. Not everyone's Amanda Palmer, who's wildly successful on her crowdfunding, but I'm trying to think of Public Enemy. They're trying to raise $150,000. And they only got halfway. So it just goes to show you, here's an artist, a band that has a long track record, and they couldn't pull it off. Now, obviously there's extenuating circumstances there, but even so, it's not as easy as just rolling it out.
No, it's not. And that's exactly what my book is about. I think that, sort of like with social media, we begin to believe that you know, if we just do it, it's easy. You know, Facebook looks easy. It's white, it's blue. You post an update. How hard could that be? Twitter, simple, 140 characters. It's actually quite complicated to get the nuance. And how do you do that? And how do you speak there? And what's an at, what's an art, what's a retweet? What, you know, you got to learn these things. And you're right. I do always say no crowd, no crowd funding, but it's not just about a crowd, because Public Enemy, certainly, if you looked, they've got a crowd. Bjork very famously failed at crowdfunding for Biophilia a couple of years ago. And I look at that and go, wait a minute, she is an international superstar. You know, currently she has a show here in New York at MoMA. You can't get in the door to see how brilliant she is. But She's not a crowdfunding artist. She's a MoMA artist. Mm-hmm. Amanda Palmer is a crowdfunding artist. Amanda Palmer from day one understood mano a mano building, one person at a time. She's wired for it. She's excellent at it. It's the way that she lives her life. It's not that she came out of nowhere and had this massive success. It's that she would always think like that. That's her way. And, you know, you and I both know plenty of artists who are just totally amazing at this. You know, they go get to the merch table after the show. They sign every scrap of paper that's put in front of them. They hug their fans. They want to be involved. There are other artists who would rather stab a pen in their eye than do that. That's just not why they got into it. So you really have to look at the personality, and you have to understand that we as a tribe of people that gather around any type of thing that we like, there's reasons why we do it, and there's ways that we expect communication. And so I could see how Public Enemy is stumbling with crowdfunding because we're not used to relating to them in that way.
See, another thing I think is, if it's the artist themselves that's involved, it's one thing. If it's their management and the artist is disconnected, I think that that can be felt. And I'm not saying that's the case of Public Enemy or anyone else, but I have a suspicion that that's, or Bjork, for instance, I have a suspicion that that's what happened, that the artist really isn't totally involved in it, and you don't feel that connection, or fans don't feel that connection.
I would agree with that. I would definitely agree with that. But also, you know, you also have to remember artists that come from the music business 1.0, as you so beautifully say, you know, they're still getting used to this whole new way of this direct communication going straight to the fan. I mean, this is still foreign for many, many, and maybe it's something that not everyone will get.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading your new book. Crowdfunding, again, is one of those things that I think everybody is interested in. And it's funny, in casual conversations that I have with friends, that always comes up. People always think, and of course, I have a lot of entrepreneurial friends, but their first thing is crowdfunding. Whether they do it or not is one thing, but it's on everyone's mind. So I predict great things for your book.
Thank you. I'm really excited to share it with the world.
Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you've ever received or you learned?
This was one that took me a long time to really get. And that is that it's okay to fire your clients. And, you know, for artists listening to this, when I say clients, I mean anyone that you serve. So if you're a touring musician, you're serving club owners, you're serving anyone that is profiting in some way off of a relationship with you. It could be a manager, you're serving your band members. In this crazy journey of wanting to succeed, and especially when it's around art, it's personal, it feels and is deeper than a lot of business relationships that normal people in the other world have. And I think that I suffered a lot trying to deliver when I couldn't, or when my client gave me something that wasn't working, and sort of flogging myself and making myself wrong instead of going, okay, what if I just walked away from this and we found someone else to do this? Or what if there could be something different here? And I think that I definitely didn't learn that until I suffered a lot. And for any of you who are in PR, it's always the publicist's fault. especially when I was a traditional publicist, you know, you could have an album that would be falling flat and the label or the management would call and scream at you. And it's normally not the publicist's fault. You never know what the fault is. It's the fault of something else really great came out that week and took all the radio slots and all the big PR slots, or a tragedy happened in the world and that's got all the news coverage. And I mean, there's a million reasons why things don't always go well, but the best piece of advice is there's power in understanding your boundaries. And when you feel that you're compromising your boundaries and you're emotionally drained and you've tried your best, it is okay to walk away from things and to do it with integrity. So whatever that takes. And if that takes giving back a little bit of the money or admitting that you didn't do it as well as you could have, or apologizing, or cleaning up your side of the street. I mean, that's a really important lesson that I think a lot of us never learn, and many of us don't learn until we've been kicked around a lot or until we've suffered. So that, I think, is the best piece of business advice. And I'll credit, I actually learned that through Michael Port, who wrote a very interesting book that I love called Book Yourself Solid, which is about how to find the right people to work with and serve in the world.
Wow. That's a good one. I have to read that. You know, I have one last question. You just brought something up. What makes a good publicist in your mind?
They should have three things. Number one, they should really be honest and have a good sense of what they can and what they cannot do. It's those publicists that are truth tellers that don't go, oh, yes, I'll get you in Pitchfork and Brooklyn Vegan and Rolling Stone and Spin. And I mean, everybody wants those things when they hire a publicist, and very few publicists actually can deliver. Not the publicist's fault, the fault of where you are in your journey, what you've done, who you're signed to, what you're doing in your career. All of these things line up directly with when it's time to get large media hits. So that's the first thing, the publicist that can manage your expectation. The second thing is the publicist who actually has a strategy. A strategy in 2015 is not blast your music out to a huge list of people and pray that some of it sticks. A strategy is actually really looking at what are we doing for the next week, month, 6 months, 7 months, 10 months, year, and how do we build your story? And then the third thing I would say, what makes a good publicist, is never work with someone that you don't like. It's just like adding a team member. It doesn't matter how good the drummer is, doesn't matter how good the sound guy is. If that person's a jerk, if you don't like the way they feel, if you don't like the way they interact with you, don't add them to your team. Not everybody gets along. Not everybody has the best bedside manner that works for everyone. If your ears prick up or you get that feeling like, I don't know, this person isn't my favorite person to talk to, but look at all the work he or she has done for X band, that's not always a reason to add them to your team.
Wow. I wish I would have followed that many times in my career.
You know, I just fired a PR firm that I hired to help me, and I didn't listen to my own advice either. So it's hard to do that.
Well, that's comforting in some way when you say that. Anyway,
well, there you go.
Thank you so much for being with me. This has been terrific as always. It's always fun to talk to you, and I always learn a lot. Thank you, Ariel.
Thanks, Bobby.
To find out more about Ariel and her cyber PR company, you can go to cyberpr.com. That's cyber, C-Y-B-E-R-P-R, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyinnercircle.com. I really love to read your comments and suggestions and questions as well. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. Thank you kindly, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab. Or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com or find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and at bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I will see you next time.